wish I was eating French toast.
Yeah, it's good. Good meal for winding down.
It's good. Wine.
So I need to address something kind of in a roundabout way.
Okay, I'm ready.
Like Socrates used to do. So, you know, I remember you told me your email, your personal email.
Yeah.
Involves your middle name.
It does.
Spelled out.
Yep.
And when you were creating the email, you misspelled your middle name, correct?
That is correct.
Misspelled your own middle name. But your email, you didn't correct it. So your email is your misspelled middle name.
Yeah.
Basically, it's part of it, right?
And it wasn't like the email company was like, hey, this is already taken, and I just changed it. I legit just misspelled it.
You misspelled your own middle name.
Yeah.
On accident. But you rolled with it because
it's been about 20 some years now of this email address existing misspelled. Continue.
Cool. Okay. So that's important background. So we have a website up now. It's still in process, but it's up, and it's got our tagline, and you know, it's the same from our tagline on Spotify and everything. And several people have pointed out to us, it says, you know, Matt, two friends, Matt and Peter, explore books and currents reads, etc. It says currents reads.
Current reads.
I just wanted to let everybody know we're aware of that, but we're much like Peter's middle name, misspelled on accident, but we're leaving it because it adds character.
I have a lot of anxiety about that when we post episodes. Like, I know there's like grammar mistakes in the description and stuff. I try to go through that with like a little, but that keeps me up at night. I'm not gonna lie.
So we know it says current reads, but we're rolling with it because it's unique. It's like the little scar on Harrison Ford's chin.
Yeah.
It adds a little something, you know?
But, I mean, we know the rules, but we're breaking them, right? Because we are reading more than one currents. Currents, you can't even defend it, really. Reads is right.
Reads is right. Or
I'm trying to think of a way to, you know, break the rules. Cormac McCarthy, the situation. He knows that quotation marks should be used. But does he use them?
No,
sorry, Bob.
No, we could make a case as experimental, right? We misspell things on purpose as a sort of way to imply or to show that there's no such thing as perfection. And so we throw it up there like an experimental artist.
It'd be like a baseball player going out to play defense, and he's like, he didn't bring his glove, and he just leans into it and says, you know what, I got these two gloves right here, my two hands, and he just plays, and then from that point on, he just doesn't use a glove.
You know, it's like Satchel Paige calling the infield, the fielders in. It's like, I'm going to spit this guy out, call the fielders in. We're going to have a book podcast, and you're going to listen to it, and we're going to have a misspelling right in the tagline.
Currents and all.
Currents reads.
Currents.
We read through the currents. It's not current as in present. Currents? It's current as in...
We're in them, right?
As in rivers, as in the riptide, as in watch out, you don't drown in books.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Currents reads.
Hey, but you know what that means? People are checking out the website. And they're probably just like, these guys are geniuses.
We're playing with fire because book people are, you know, not all of them. A high proportion of grammar Nazis are book people, and that's our target audience. And so we're just tempting them right away. Hey, hate us because there's a grammar error just right there.
I was a MFA, that was my focus, or not MFA, sorry, I didn't go that far.
EA?
I was just English major, but I focused on creative writing. I don't know, I gave myself an MFA. I gave myself an MFA.
You say you're in the MFA program.
I did accidentally once take an advanced, I thought it was a capstone course, You just focus on one author, William Faulkner, and you just read all their works, and you just a whole semester. And somehow I got into the class, and you kind of got introduced the first day in the class, and the teacher goes, you know, introduce yourself and what you're like focused on in the class. And I was like, huh, that's weird. And so the MFA program where I went to school at CSU, you would focus either on poetry or fiction. And everyone went around and said like what year they were in. Like I'm year one, year two, because I think it was a 2-year program. And I realized quickly, oh, I shouldn't be in this class because I'm an undergrad.
It was all grad students.
And I was just like, okay. Drop the class. 2 days. Yeah, I think I went 2 days. I had taken too many classes too anyway, so it was, anyway, that was a digression. My story was, I was in a creative writing class once, and your peers would, you would get into like smaller groups, your peers would read your stories, they would comment on them, and then, I don't know what you were supposed to do with that, but anyway, one time this classmate wrote in the kind of margins, like, I can't remember what exactly it said, but something to the extent of, there are so many grammatical errors in this, I had to stop. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, eh, okay, that, fair enough. I was like, that's good. You need that.
Hey, that's what editors are for, exactly. You know? The juice is in the story and the style. They can fix grammatical type.
I think I was better at poetry for that reason, because it's a little less grammatically, like...
Yeah, you can pretend like it's part of the poem.
I break the rules because I break the rules, you know?
Yeah. I'm not dumb. I'm a rebel.
I'm not a dummy. I know I'm not supposed to drive in the median, but guess what? It's poems about life. And guess what? Yeah. The meaning of life is in the median.
Life doesn't always conform to the rules either.
I only make left turns. How about that?
That's good. So we're leaving Currents in there.
We just leave Currents in there.
Currents reads. That's how it goes.
You know, if someone was from, I don't know, Paris, let's say they didn't speak English perfectly, I don't think they would notice.
They probably wouldn't even notice. Or they learn English wrong.
Or they could learn, yeah.
Currents.
Currents.
Yeah, they learn English through this podcast and...
Slap an S on that thing, okay? Currents. Currents reads. I think I might start using it, to be honest.
Currents reads. Let's make it a thing. You know, it's interesting. I watched a couple months ago, actually, Pumping Iron, that documentary about Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 70s.
That's the least surprising thing you said in a while.
That I watched the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary?
Yeah.
I had time on my hands. Anyway, it's entertaining. It's interesting. You could see he's kind of charismatic. You could see why they put him in movies, right? But he speaks English with his accent like he does. But there's a couple times when he's talking about plural stuff, he says spaghettis. And then he's talking about Lou Ferrigno and how Lou Ferrigno is not going to be a problem competition-wise, because I will take him under my wing and I will give him bad advices. He says advices, right? And I noticed just those few things. And I just kind of wonder, I was like, oh, I bet in Austrian, because they're spaghettis and advice, it's multiple sets. So it is plural. Mm. And he just kind of naturally uses the plural form. It's wrong, but it's like a minor thing. And I remember thinking, I bet in...
You know there's no language called Austrian, right?
German?
Yes.
I know. So in Australian, I bet there's... But is it... Do you know enough German? Is it... Do they do plurals different in German? I bet just the conversion. I remember thinking, you know, that's interesting he does that. I could see why. My kid does it too. He'll see the cat foods and he'll say Ember's cat foods, because there's multiple little cans of those little foods. So he'll say cat foods. I was like, oh, he's gonna grow up to be Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And on that note, welcome to the Rolly Books, a podcast about books and Currents Reads. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Good intro.
Thanks. Austrian. Yeah, I knew that, awesome. But not at the time. I was like,
oh. You said it, and I was like, did he? Okay. Yeah. I kind of agree. I think every country should have a language, you know.
Yeah, well, they don't speak Austrian in Austria.
They don't, for that matter. We have a fun episode tonight. We are going to be discussing one book. We're kind of go back to, I think we've kind of done some hodgepodge and nomination episodes lately, and we're going to be discussing the 1852 novel, The Blithedale Romance by Nathaniel Hawthorne. We're going back quite a ways. I can't remember last time have we done a book this? We've done some Roman texts and such, but 1850s.
Yeah, Anabasis is the old, but then Count of Monte Cristo. But yeah, kind of old.
And you had nominated Hawthorne in this book. I actually never heard of this book before. I'll be completely honest.
Yeah.
Scarlet Letter, I've heard of. I might have read parts of that in school. The House of Seven Gables. There's a short story one. Blanking on. It's very
just strange. The Marble Fawn. He's got a lot of short stories.
Keep talking. Why can't I remember this? I don't know. So I had some experience. I was kind of curious to dip my toe back into Hawthorne as an adult who's not forced to read him.
Is exactly. That
fair? Yeah.
Yeah. I had been forced to read Scarlet Letter in high school. I didn't like it. I didn't like anything you're supposed to read in high school. So I was curious to re-engage.
And it was... The book is about kind of an interesting subject, which you sold me on, kind of a utopian society or an attempt at cooperative of some sort and sort of the failings of that in a way.
Yeah, it doesn't pan out. And it's kind of these people in, I guess it'd be roughly 1840s. It was written in 1852. Based loosely on Hawthorne's actual experience in one of those communities in the 1840s, I believe. But I get a lot of that stuff was going on back then. It was a big period of social transition in America and the world. It was, agricultural societies kind of moving towards industrialization, and there was a lot of hunger for stuff like that. It's just people wanted something. The industrial factory working, the condition in the cities, working in factories and that sort of everything we take for granted now as the way of life, the 9-to-5 grind was just kind of beginning, and people kind of being kind of forced off their farms and into the cities they didn't like. So they're looking for something else. And so a lot of these little utopian communities sprung up where people get together, farm the land, share the labor equally, and, we go from there. And this is kind of a tale of that happening. And, it'll be minor spoilers. Yeah. We won't worry too much. There's not too much, but it doesn't pan out. And this is kind of a little story about why and what happens.
I thought, just from the beginning, overall, I liked the book. I enjoyed parts of it. There were parts that didn't exactly click for me, and we can kind of get into that later. But I enjoyed the way in which he sets up and describes the society and sort of the faults of it. And he's very, I found it to be very, with the writing style, it was kind of like he kind of just slowly, he didn't hold your hand as he was kind of telling you, oh, these people are kind of our narrators, ill-prepared, I guess, to kind of enter in this endeavor of, this utopian society of, agriculture and whatnot. And he kind of places some of these characters in contrast to somebody who is actually it's a minor character or a secondary character, who's competent at this.
The Silas Foster. Silas Foster.
There's moments of that in his descriptions where it's very perceptive and almost like attacking these sort of people who are like, oh, you know what? I kind of want to go do this thing where I'm with these kind of like-minded people. And it's, and then it, I like the way he undercuts all that sort of thinking with, oh, the weather's really bad. And you know what I mean? Like the harshness of nature kind of undercuts some of the
ideals of the people. Oh, they're not equipped to deal with kind of just the reality. Like you're going to have to deal with the weather being bad if you're going to be a farmer. But they have this kind of, a lot of the main characters who are kind of running this thing are kind of not, they're naive and they're idealistic, which kind of leads to them not being equipped to deal with reality. Mm-hmm. But having said that, it's not like a polemic. It's not political, really. It's more of like a drama. Or it's called The Blythe Romance. It's a romance in the older sense of just a emotional story.
Tied on to sort of the utopian society, I guess, is.
And if you, it's not an angry polemic where he's like, this failed because it's not really political, but why if you kind of chew on like the main characters in the book and their personalities. You kind of think about it, you're like, oh yeah, that's why it failed, because they're all caught up in their own thing. And it's, I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very good. I don't know, it was subtle. He doesn't come out and spell it out for you.
I agree.
The more you sit with it, and then you get back, it's old timey language, but kind of like Shakespeare, you get into the groove, you don't notice it anymore. It's just, it's different at first, but you pick it up quick. It's,
I found it's definitely like a different register than what we're kind of used to reading, I would say, right? But I found like there's quite a bit of enjoyment as if you're paying attention and you're following his ideas through like maybe like a couple pages, like sometimes that's how, kind of how long it takes.
Yeah.
It's pretty enjoyable. You're like, oh, I see what he's doing here. That's multiple steps. So there's, I wouldn't say it's complex, like, right? But sort of how an idea gets developed is in a way complex.
Yeah. Well, it's not difficult,
but it's, you have to be thinking and engaging with the work, right? In a way that is maybe not typical of books written today, I guess.
It's attention spans, right? This is the 1850s. So you could become famous. Like people actually read books back then for fun. There wasn't television or movies competing for your attention span. And so it would take a page or two to get an idea across and people wouldn't get antsy or fidgety while reading.
It also felt like intellectual. Did you get that sense of the ideas being discussed? Cause it's not just utopian. There's a romance element. There is a, you could easily write, if you're in college right now and you had to write a paper on this, one of the major themes in is like gender roles and how they are kind of dealt with. There's kind of a,
one of the main characters is a feminist, and then there's another character who's kind of more old school in his attitudes. And our author, who's kind of the moody poet type, is sympathetic to the feminist. Mm-hmm. Do you want to break down real quick? There's really four or five characters. Our narrator is Miles Coverdale. It's kind of loosely based on Hawthorne, like it's like Hawthorne kind of stripped of success, right? It's kind of a poet, a guy who considers himself a poet, but he's in his head a lot. He doesn't really do anything or act, or Hawthorne wasn't quite like that, but just kind of a poet who's in his head, notices things, maybe embellishes a little bit, but it realizes when he's embellishing, but he'll kind of tell you.
I saw something where I didn't click with me when I was reading the book, but afterwards that he was just, I saw something where he was described as like a voyeur in a way.
Kind of is.
Yeah. And he does, if you think about it, there's a scene sort of later on in the book where he's left the kind of Blithedale when he's like back in the city, and he's very much like a voyeur, like watching people.
Yeah,
like
in another he has building. Faults. He's between the lines. You can kind of see, like, oh, he's, he's got his faults. but he describes what he sees pretty accurately. And I think he has, for the most part, he kind of has the other character's number. Like, he knows what makes them tick, their faults, all that stuff. He's good at describing it. Anyway, so, and then there's a mysterious veiled lady at the beginning. That's kind of like a clairvoyant stage show. She's like the main attraction. There's kind of like a little mystery. She's on the cover of My Penguin Classic Edition, The Veiled Woman. Mm. One of the main female character here, one of the people, I guess, running the co-op or the...
Yeah, kind of like a major influence of people actually coming to the...
The personality farm. Behind it is Zenobia, which is like a fake name within the story. It's not, she presumably has a full Christian name. We just don't know it. It's just Zenobia, like a stage name, basically. And she's very attractive with a forceful personality, feminist, you know. And that's kind of a political type person who's kind of the face of the utopian community they're running there. There is a girl, Priscilla, kind of the waifish, quiet seamstress. She makes little purses, which symbolism. She makes things that contain things, right, and are kind of sewn up. She's a diminutive woman. So is Zenobia and Priscilla are the two kind of, not extremes, but parallel types of women for back then who would be at this community. And kind of opposite to Miles Coverdale is Hollingsworth, who is charismatic, kind of obsessed with criminal reform, the type of zealous with a Z, zealous type person who are drawn to things like this. He and Coverdale start out being friends, but there's kind of tension there, and they have a falling out. But those are our main, Zenobia, Priscilla, Hollingsworth, Coverdale are the main engines, our main characters, and the story plays out with a drama between those four, basically.
I'm curious about your answer to this. Were you surprised by how much you could take from this book and apply it to, like, today, like in our society? Because I was like finding stuff.
I was hoping
that reminds me of this, or that kind of personality, or that trait. You see that all the time. Because I just was surprised. I'm like, oh,
there's a lot of it.
Yeah,
I was hoping that would be the case. That's why I nominated it, is because I kind of figured there would. I'd read about this in that book I read about con men in American history in the 1840s. This came up.
Okay.
Like all these utopian places that came up, they almost always failed because, as genuine and well-meaning as 99% of the people there were, it leaves yourself open to the con man or just the self-interested person who Hollingsworth is
a fascinating character, in my opinion, because
he's well drawn, and he's not even a sociopath. He's just kind of self-involved.
Yes,
right. But the guy in the con man book I read, like, these idealistic communities, people mean well, but you leave yourself vulnerable to ruthless people, and they will take advantage of you. And so I figure that dynamic hasn't changed. There's less utopian communities now, but whatever your idealism is, however well-meaning you are, you always leave yourself open to wolves and sheep. Wolves who dress up as sheep and pretend to be one of you, but take advantage of
you. I think utopian societies are not like sort of I think they've sort of morphed into something else. Where at one point they were like, you actually had houses and you had tasks and jobs. It's almost like there are online communities that sort of like want to be this utopian thing of like set ideals and
they say just act this way and the world will be better. It's like, well, you gotta count.
And there's a figurehead, and I mean, Hollingsworth is, when you're reading this book, he comes out and says, like, if you don't support like my ideas, I don't have time for you. And it's very like,
he says literally 150 years before George W. Bush, if you're not with me, you're against me.
Yeah,
it's almost verbatim, that phrase is in Hollywood. And he's just very obsessed with criminal reform. Like, to the point, like, and there's some very good quotes that Coverdale has about people who are obsessed with one thing. It's their ideology. They're not even wrong about it, but it's just their driving motive is this one political thing and how it kind of corrupts them almost to where they can't maintain friendships. Your friends, the people you surround yourself with, have to be as obsessed with you, or they fall by the wayside, or they're seen as not sufficient in their zeal
because they judge, they
condemning you. People like that tend to like to condemn things.
Yes.
Probably not even consciously, but their motive isn't to really make the world a better place or anything. It's they feed their neurons, their brains are kind of wired to get pleasure from just condemning things. And they're not even wrong. The things they're condemning are wrong, but the type of person you become when you're that obsessed with one thing. Like, that is also, that happens currently.
Yeah. You know? But no, I thought, let's see here. I there was a section in the book that was, there's kind of like, it's sort of in the beginning. But how can you be my lifelong friend except you strive with me towards the great object of my life? It's very like self-centered. Like, if you're going to be my friend, you have to be in with my ideals, going towards my, like, it's very like, holy cow. Like, this is, I mean, people like that have been around for hundreds of years. And it's just, I don't know. There were many times in this book where I was like, oh, this is very much applicable to today. Like, you could kind of change the scenery and update some of the language, you know, costumes, language, and all that stuff, and you'd be like, oh, this fits in perfectly with how people act.
Switch the cop and switch the cops. Make it what, not
criminal reform, or, but yeah, there's
whatever, like, it is today. Yeah. It's
in this online world we all live in, there's like these little groups of people that I think mean well, but it's so, I don't know, protective or
predictive of the ideology. People, if you don't believe in this thing, you're going to be ostracized, or you can't be around me because you don't believe exactly what I believe on this thing. Well, and it's interesting, Hawthorne kind of nailed the type of person that he presumably saw in his own co-op, right? So he nailed, that's just a part of human nature. Technology, social media hasn't changed human nature. It just kind of amplifies that aspect of it, and you're treated to more of it. You can see thousands. You can see that scenario play out thousands of ways, thousands of different issues. But the type of person that is drawn to a single political issue or makes their personality about politics, you can see that totally play out in the same way as Hollingsworth in social media, just amplified by thousands, like, it's louder, you see more people do it, you know. But it's really interesting to see.
It was that character stood out to me. And I kind of mentioned this before, but I enjoyed the sort of capable farmer who, this is just their like life, and sort of near the end there's sort of this tragedy that happens, but they kind of just move on from it without sort of the emotional effect that it affects other characters. But
stoically,
I really enjoyed that aspect of, because it's subtle, like you said, like the book isn't, I don't feel like it's heavy-handed in a way, but it's
actually, I would argue it's not at all. This stuff is lightly, Hawthorne's not, it doesn't come off as angry, like I said earlier, or polemical. It just kind of lays there. And you can see it. It's a gentle.
I enjoyed the part where he, at one point, he mentions like nature, I guess is one way you could put it, but like the animals of the farm were like clearly like disgusted that these people didn't know how to actually farm. Like, oh, they didn't know like the small details, right? Oh, they're sitting on the wrong side of the cow when they're kind of, all these sort of small things. And it's just like, I enjoyed that sort of, very subtle, very light, and it's kind of, the story moves on from there, but definitely has like a little bit of a sting to it in parts.
That's a funny observation. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just
these people come here to farm the land. They don't know what they're doing.
Because
what's funny, and Coverdale, Hawthorne's very good about kind of poking fun of the intellectual slash poet who are drawn to these things. Like Coverdale gets sick right away.
Yeah.
You know, and he's laid up in bed, which I think is also kind of funny. Like the intellectual who's here to participate and change the world can't really get out and do much for the first few weeks because he's sick in bed. Yeah.
I also, the idea of loneliness too, it's kind of brought up a little bit. Like he feels lonely in this sort of, you would think like, oh, it's a community where we're kind of doing this ideals and whatnot. I thought that was an interesting thing. I hadn't really thought of like when you're in this kind of group, then maybe you would feel extremely lonely, even though it's kind of trying to combat that in a way. But I don't know.
I think Coverdale might be his personality. He's not outgoing. He's actually kind of really, really in his head and withdrawn from the world. That's one of his faults. He's a 5 on the Enneagram, Peter.
Yeah, I like it.
Like for real, that would be, he would be most definitely that. But Zenobia and Priscilla and Hollingsworth are kind of the three characters he's obsessed with. And you find out at the end he's been in love with one of the women, but you wouldn't have guessed that from kind of the way he behaves. He doesn't pursue her or make any sort of inroads or anything like that because he's observing and he's in his head. It's one of his faults. I think it's pretty done by Hawthorne. You kind of realize he's just observing, not really pitching in. And one of the reasons the co-op fails is because the intellectual observer guy doesn't really pitch in either.
Yeah, Hawthorne says to an extent, like, you can't be both a farmer and a poet at the same time. You have to be one or the other.
Yeah. But, you know, he's there. Like, why are you here? You know. Yeah. So the political people who are running the show are kind of self-involved, narcissistic-ish. Hollingsworth wants to come in and take the land for a little criminal reform facility. You get the feeling Zenobia is maybe just kind of doing this on a lark or because it seems a cool thing to do, but they don't really know how to farm. You can just see why this thing doesn't last and falls apart because of all these different reasons, just kind of the way people are, the way human nature.
Yeah, human nature gets in the way of these. Because I was trying to think of like, what's the end goal of a utopian society? What are these kind of, like, throughout history, this is not like a unique thing, really. It happens. You sent me a text about something that kind of very similar that's going on with, very, you know, Elon.
I think had it worked out, right, what the characters would want would be just perpetual, like you live there the rest of your life and then your kids live there and it just becomes a self-perpetuating thing, right?
But there always seems to be with like a utopian society of trying to keep the sense of this is perfect, like almost to the point of you will eventually snap, like you will eventually break in a weird way, that trying to have these ideals and have this perfect life, right, that, you know, it almost feels like the Truman Show in a weird way. Like, you know, it seems perfect in a way, but eventually, like, everything will snap and break once a minor crack appears. Or what's a society where everything appears perfectly and then characters just start to break. Stepford Wives,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's just all this that's in the background. Matt's son is agreeing with us on this. But I don't know. I always feel like the societies can only last for so long. Like I can't imagine human nature that people will, someone will feel like, what am I doing here? Right.
Yeah. Well,
is not the same for everybody.
Yeah. Well, and I think that notion of perfection probably prevents it from becoming long lasting.
What would your,
nothing's perfect. Things that last have to take in human nature and frailty and mistakes into account. You can't be like Collingsworth and just, you know, insist on perfection and everybody following in line. That's not how things work. You have to be like the farmer. The farmer's presumably still there.
Oh, yeah.
Like once all the dreamers and schemers and everybody leave, the farmer's still farming his land. You're right, because he's...
It reminds me of, like, it's a fad. Like, oh, farming's a fad. Or, like, for some, like, the city people. Oh, I want to, you know, raise... And it's... But it's also a... It's the idea of, oh, it's unique, therefore it's better. Like, oh, it's different than what I'm doing now, so therefore it must be correct. Like, if I'm not happy with my life now and I'm in the city, then the opposite must be true. But it's really just a changing of... Because to that farmer, they still... It's not... I don't know. It's just a kind of interesting idea, right? Yeah.
Well, it's all those old cliches, the whole wherever you go, there you are. You don't see the world as it is, you see it as you are. So if you're cranky and dissatisfied with everything, you're going to be cranky and dissatisfied in the country. But you go on vacation, if you're cranky and dissatisfied here and you go on vacation to Paris, Paris isn't going to fix it. You're going to be cranky and dissatisfied in Paris.
You still got to do all the same things.
You still got to work. But I think things like these could work. I think you have to be less brittle with your concept of perfection. There's a community of people who could go live somewhere and just farm and get along. You're just going to have to account for the drama. You can't have this notion of perfection. You're just going to have to take human nature into account, realize it, probably the less political it is, the better, the less single issue political, you know.
But I also think they inherently draw confidence men to them, which are going to be a problem.
Easy marks. They tend to be naive, you know, especially the younger you are, you're more, you see a problem. It's just like, oh, we just have everybody in the world stop doing this and it'll be fixed.
Yeah.
It's like, well,
yeah,
that sounds great. But the older you get, you realize that's never going to happen. Yeah. You're never going to change human nature. So
it's interesting. It definitely seems like a young person thing.
It's everybody, and it's not. Yeah, it's all sides of the spectrum. It's all any ideology. Your ideology isn't going to fix.
I think there's no one who's like, oh, they're more prone to thinking about this than I think that any person can be like, oh, you know what? I want my society to look like this.
Yeah,
because sounds great. Sounds good. Because I'm like, why can't this work?
But there's a whole like little area of Twitter, people who make pretty accurate assessments of society and what's wrong with society. Like I tend to agree with them, but then they're like, we'll just go off grid and drink raw milk and eat fresh meat and we'll just all go off grid. It's like, oh yeah, that sounds great, but good luck with that.
Yeah, the go-off-grid stuff is a little bit of a utopian, but like a smaller, individualized world.
And people could do it, but I think a community, the type of people who, like, we'll get a community together and we'll just all go off-grid, I imagine it playing out very much like this.
It's almost like, why don't we all go off-grid? And like for this analogy, it'd be like, oh yeah, I'll go off grid with you. How many people can go? Oh, we only have space for 4 people. And you're like, oh well, there's like 10,000 of us that live in town.
How many of you know how to farm? How many of you know how to hunt?
Yeah,
all the drama and baggage and stuff inherent with human nature will follow you to the mountains or wherever you're going. You know, you're not going to fix that.
So and I think,
yeah.
Oh, for me, the book really works on what we're talking about here, that utopian, the concepts, how he deals with that. I will say where I kind of was lost interest a little bit was kind of the like quote unquote romance of our characters and their sort of how they break apart and all that felt, I don't know, not a different book, but just a not as interesting book. Just for me, that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I really like the utopian aspect of the book versus the the veiled lady parts, the dynamic of, it just felt not as interesting for me. And that's just my opinion. Other people might be just as interesting because it's a different kind of set of questions the book is, you know, asking and answering in a way. But that's just my opinion about the book, kind of.
I could see that.
Your thoughts?
And I will say it doesn't follow the typical contours of a romance.
Yeah.
You know, like you kind of want, you want deep down, me too. Like you want the hero to come in and either win the girl, win his love interest, or fail tragically, mm-hmm. right? You want these big, bold beats. It doesn't do that. And I like what he did with the Coverdale character a lot. And so I see a lot of him being in love with, it's minor spoilers. He's been in love with Priscilla the whole time. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't reveal it until literally the very last sentence. And so you work backwards. You're like, wait, that doesn't make sense. He hasn't really pursued her. But it's not a flaw in the writing on Hawthorne's part. I think it's intentionally done because you kind of, the character this whole time has been distant in his head, observing the whole thing, but not really participating. So the romantic stuff playing out, not in your typical way, I think it's done intentionally.
Yeah.
To kind of highlight the type of character this guy is. And I think it works, but the part of you that wants the other type of romance, you want those typical things. It doesn't happen. And then the flip side of it, Hollingsworth, his charm, he's charismatic. And Zenobia is in love with Hollingsworth. And spoilers again, Hollingsworth winds up with Priscilla.
Yeah.
So both of the women, both ends of the spectrum, the very beautiful, charismatic, and the kind of diminutive and retreating woman, both love Hollingsworth. I also think that's kind of intentional. It's not pleasant. It's not fun. Hollingsworth's kind of a caveman, especially in his attitudes towards the feminism espoused by Zenobia. But despite all that, they're both in love with him. I think there's something very true about that, even though it's not fun story-wise. There was the one scene, I kind of chuckled at it. Zenobia is giving kind of a lecture on feminism. And it all sounds very modern. Most people would not along. And, you know, men control, all the sort of feminist stuff, like I agree with.
Yeah, yeah.
Coverdale, our narrator, agrees with it. And he smiles to himself about something else, right? He's just enjoying the way Zenobia is talking about it. And he smiles. Zenobia sees it, assumes he's laughing at her, kind of calls him out in front of everybody. He says, what do you agree? And there's this whole long-winded thing. Coverdale is like, I agree with you more than it, you know, just agrees with her. And she kind of digs at him, right? And it kind of teases him. And then Hollingsworth chimes in with his opinion, and he gives this like old school biblical caveman type, women need to be under a strong man's, what does he say? Women need to be with a strong man.
Basically exact opposite of what
the old school.
Yeah.
What she said, what she believes. And she, this strong-willed woman with firm convictions, kind of blushes and says, oh, maybe you're right.
Because she's very, yeah.
It's not kind of what you want story-wise, I guess. And if you're, you know, a feminist reading this, you might be like, hey, but I kind of laugh because there is something true about that. Like your animal attraction to people overrides your ideology. Or like Zenobia isn't really in love with our narrator, Coverdale, at all. Even though he agrees with her, he's a better political ally.
He seems like a better match in a way.
Yeah, you would think.
He's the poet. He's the, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But attraction doesn't work that way.
She's attracted to Hollingsworth
until the very end when he betrays her, which is his character. But you know what I mean? It's like there's something deeply true about that, even though it's not the story you want. It's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's how it goes.
I had another thought when I was reading this. I've seen if you agree or not, but you know, we talked earlier about like Hawthorne is, you know, you're forced to read them right in school and whatnot. I did feel like this book was very like, it made my academic quote unquote brain work, where I was like, there are a lot of like themes and irony. There's a lot of like literary techniques at play here. And so I came away thinking, oh, I understand why maybe he's been taught for, you know, over 100 years in school. Because there is a lot of things to unpack, think about, you know, write about, you know, look at it through different lens. It felt like, oh, literary theory, which I had to take a class in college. Not my favorite subject, but this would be a book where you could be like, oh, you could throw a half dozen different literary theory lenses on this work and you could write a 20-page paper on it. I don't know if you did you get a sense that like, oh, I understand why Hawthorne is taught in sort of an academic way, or did that not cross your mind at all?
Oh yeah, no, I thought of that. There's a lot of the symbolism. And I find sometimes the symbolism in high school, especially in college, I found it kind of boring. You know, looking for the symbols rather than just enjoying the story. But I guess when you're not being forced to read it, you see it on your own. You're like, oh, I kind of get it. There's one really obvious one at the end.
Which one?
You want to just spoilers about it. If you're intrigued, you know, stop listening here. But so at the end, Hollingsworth betrays Zenobia. I'm pretty sure because she loses her money and Priscilla inherits the money. And so Hollingsworth switches allegiances for the money. Zenobia winds up drowning herself because she's so heartbroken. And there's a pretty well-drawn scene at the end where they're looking for her body in the river at night with the farmer, Coverdale, Hollingsworth, and the farmer. And when they're like, you know, shoving poles to the bottom to like feel for a body, and Hollingsworth finds her, I believe, and they pull her up, and the pole had hit her in the heart, and whoever pulls her up says, oh, she's a wound in the heart, but she drowned herself because of Hollingsworth's betrayal. That was like, I remember thinking like, oh, there's your high school paper. Like, that's a very, very obvious, oh, she has a wound in the heart. And Hollingsworth is like, what? So, yeah, symbolism.
But, no, but yeah, I see what you're saying. But I don't know if a lot of books engage at all. Maybe they do it in a few aspects of sort of the conventional, I want to say, like how a book or a novel was thought to have, you're supposed to write a novel and you're supposed to include all these things and like symbols and all that. Sometimes I feel like you rarely see like all of it kind of come together, right? Because I feel like Hawthorne knows like, okay, what a novel is supposed to include, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's supposed to include.
Yeah, and I wonder some of the older stuff. Like, I gather Melville was like Moby Dick.
Melville and Hawthorne, if I remember correctly, were correspondents.
So. Maybe they did that more back then.
Yeah.
Back in the day. Yeah. And they did it well. It's not like symbolism. I kind of cringe at symbolism because you're kind of forced to look for it in weird places.
But if it's subtle and it's sort of. I know what you're saying, because symbolism, like heavy handed, is just like, okay. Like,
yeah.
It gets a little, like, if it's too on the
nose,
it's a little. Kind of disengages you from the story a bit.
But when done, I'm curious. I like the few I've read recently. I like this era of American literature. Like, I like the Washington Irving I read.
Mm-hmm.
I like this kind of early American stuff. I'd be curious. I'm really curious about House of Seven Gables.
I've heard that's his best work. Scarlet Letter is obviously his most famous work.
I'd revisit Scarlet Letter as an adult. I think I might appreciate it. A lot of people said about this one, it's not his best. It's the House of Seven Gables or Scarlet Letter, but you know, they talked about it like, oh, it's a pleasant enough little thing. So I really liked it though. I think it's a really subtle, well constructed. It gives you a lot to think about. I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, it surprised me too about how much I took from it. Like that was the surprising part. I was like, oh, how many of the ideas in the book are, oh, I could think about this with not just, you know, from the 1840s or whatever, when the book kind of is set, but currently. And I think that's a mark of a book that, you know, from an author that has thought about these ideas and has drawn up characters that kind of show off. The more I think about it, I think the book rises in my sort of esteem, I guess, in a way.
I think if you nail people, you get what makes people tick, you'll seem timeless. You'll even seem prescient because people don't change. You know, the surroundings and settings and technology changes, but people are people. And so this, if you really nail what people are like, you'll be able to read a book in the 1850s now and be like, oh yeah, I recognize that, because there are Hollingsworths, there are Zenobias, there are Priscillas, there are Coverdale. Like there's all these types of people and attitudes that exist today. Even if the ideology is different, there are still ideologies, and the types of people that come at these ideologies and imbibe them and how they behave towards other people because of the ideology, that stuff's timeless.
Yeah. So it's also fascinating too. It's always kind of fun to read about. So especially with an author who is like keen and interested in sort of getting into the weeds of some of these ideas. So any final quotes, thoughts, theories?
Some stuff. Some errata.
There you go.
And maybe I'm using that word right. Maybe I'm not. Who knows? I like to part runtime cover towards the beginning. Coverdale is talking, and this would go on to cost me many a groan, like future headaches, basically. I like that. I'm gonna steal that. Cost me many a groan.
That's good.
Yeah, I don't like that. I like
put that on the header of Currents Reads.
Currents Reads, many a groan. When he's about to have his falling out with Hollingsworth, Coverdale says, had I loved him less, I might have used him better.
That's pretty good.
The little line.
There are a lot of good quotes in this book.
Yeah.
A lot of
longer ones at length, I guess we won't get to.
Yeah.
But, we hold mirth to a greater accountability than sorrow. Because towards the beginning, especially, Priscilla's kind of quietly happy-go-lucky. Not a lot bothers her. And everyone's like, what's this girl's deal? And Hawthorne kind of meditates on, you know, if she were cranky all the time, people would kind of take it like, oh yeah, of course she's cranky, but she's happy. And everyone kind of looks at her like an oddity. And that's what we hold mirth to a greater accountability than sorrow. She was sad all the time. People wouldn't bat an eye. They're like, oh, there's a sad girl. But like, why is she so happy?
Why are you happy?
And that's another thing.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's true today too.
That's very good point. Work?
Like, why is that lady so happy? But is she cranky? Like, yeah, of course she's cranky.
Life. You got stuff.
Yeah. She's at work. She's cranky.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's
There's the guy Westerveld, kind of the
he's a strange guy.
Handler of the Veiled Lady. Coverdale doesn't trust him immediately, kind of rightly so. He's a shady guy. And he's got fake teeth, and they really stand out. And he says, every human being, when given over to the devil, is sure to have the wizard mark on him. Westerveld's case, it's the teeth. There's always something, despite a handsome facade or whatever, there's always a little something about them that gives them away.
The mark of the evil. Devil.
Mark of the devil. All right, have you ever seen the weird thing I got on my head?
Yeah, I see it. That's not the mark of the devil. Anything, you could be like, you know.
What? Let's see. Possible titles before he settled on the Blithedale romance. This is for it, like,
these I read real? This. Okay.
Yeah, real. Blithedale. Hollingsworth. Zenobia, Priscilla, just everybody's name. This is my favorite one.
I was gonna say these are okay.
Just, yeah. Miles Coverdale's three friends. That sounds like a sitcom. I actually really like.
That sounds like a Peaky Woodhouse story.
Yeah, Miles really does, doesn't it? The Veiled Lady.
Honestly, I could have seen that, yeah.
That could work. And this might be the best one. The Arcadian Summer.
Mm, that is pretty good.
Nice. Yeah.
But I think Blithedale Romance works too. Be like the romance part, that's the key part of the title.
Yeah.
The romantic, romancing the idea of the utopian society and also the romance of the characters with each other.
I see why they settled on it. But Arcadian Summer.
Arcadian Summer sounds like a good song. Good.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
Mm-hmm. I like Miles Coverdale's Three Friends as well.
Miles Coverdale's Three Friends. To say nothing of the farm. Yeah.
To say nothing of Silas Foster.
Who was actually the guy who fed them.
Some of those old books have big, long titles
they
like
do,
that.
They do, and they're clever.
Like Tristram Shandy, the official, the life and times of Tristram Shandy, it's like a paragraph long title.
Yeah. With the, there's the three men in the boat to say nothing of the dog. Is that? That
oh, one? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That it's might have been nominated at one point from us. So.
Was.
Hawthorne, I think we should come back to him.
Yeah. House Seven Gables.
Short story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or venture off into maybe dabble into Melville or some other authors that maybe aren't as prominent from this time frame in American literature. I think would be something worthwhile for us.
Washington Irving I really liked. There's more to the Legend of Sleepy Hollow story than pop culture. The cartoon, what you think it is, the Headless Horseman is actually more of a fun story than that. And there's a lot of stuff like this, like it's subtle, you kind of sit with it. Like this era of literature might be worth pursuing.
Piques your interest.
There's a lot more there. Yeah. I also liked the last little note. The Coverdale comes out and says it at one point. He knows he's not, in his narrative, he's obsessed. His central people are Priscilla, Zenobia, and Hollingsworth.
Mm-hmm.
So there, but he in their life on the farm, he's like a second or third rate character in their lives, right?
Definitely agree.
I like the idea of being kind of the people in your life that you're obsessed with, but being like second or third in theirs. There's a kind of a difference in.
Well, it creates a friction level. Too in the story, right?
When yeah.
It's not like an equal.
They put up with him when he's around, but sometimes it's like Gunther and Friends or something. He's not part of the group. Does that, you know what I mean? Like an outsider to the main group.
You know what just struck me is like, this is almost, we talk about Flashman, like the, not like the idea of doing a Flashman with, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I almost feel like you could do that with this book, or it's already been done where like, Miles Coverdale's story is like, he's like the probably not the most important person in this story, right? He's like a
no, he's just our narrator, yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of a weird,
yeah, like a guy in the background. It's like Friends told from a Gunther's perspective or something,
yes,
or an ancillary.
That's a very Seinfeld, that's actually perfect,
you know what I mean? Like Seinfeld from Newman or something, but just like you have your main characters who all get along and they're all there, but you're getting the story from the outsider who's only there. From a supporting character.
Yeah.
You know what? It's what the fifth business is in Robertson Davies. From what you got the first part from a guy on the outside. Hey, that's a good literary construct.
Look at us. Are we getting smarter at this? At the books?
No.
We're not getting smarter.
We're the same. We read a smart book. We're the same level of dumb. But this the subject matter elevates us. To headier topics, but it's not necessarily.
Yeah, we doubt. We
movie, TV show. Would you like to see this made?
Miniseries.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was gonna say it'd be a good movie.
I could see that. I think I
Or
would want
someone.
it. You could draw this out a little bit, I feel
If
like.
I would want the British to do it.
I
You
agree.
know how they do two or three episodes and just let's quit? I don't want Netflix or American television to draw it out longer than it's there. But I think it could be a good movie or, yeah, a little British miniseries.
Three or
Like
four
you just
episodes is all I'm asking.
yeah.
I don't
And
want
then.
8, 10. I don't want 2 seasons. I want 1 season.
Yeah. There's only
Each
do the show.
episode, yeah. But I could, a movie
But
would work too. I could see that.
I'd be excited if they did it. If the right
Honestly,
people did it, I'd
you know
watch
when
it.
you
I think.
read something and you're like, I wonder if this will ever like catch in society. Like, oh, you remember, like sometimes certain books that are like seemingly forgotten sort of like have a reawakening.
Yeah.
I vaguely have a sense that this book could have that.
You could. There are
In a
some
weird way,
people
if
out there.
someone with influence is like, you know what, this book from 175 years ago really made me think about
Well,
roles
British
and
people do, and this is an American author, so I
yeah.
wonder if that's why. But the BBC is always churning out those old the Jane Austen, the
Yeah.
Brontes, like all those costume dramas. You could do something like that. I mean, this is set in Massachusetts in the 1840s. And if you were subtle about it, I wouldn't want it to be too heavy-handed. I wouldn't want them to update it for modern morality. I would want you'd have the parallels there, but subtly done. Don't hit us over the head with it, but just kind of make it the, oh man, yeah, you could do it really well if you were subtle about it.
BBC, if you need a if
BBC.
adaptation, The Blithedale Romance by
I mean,
Nathaniel
they do stuff
Hawthorne.
like that. People like, you could market it. People
Oh
like,
yeah.
they people like that updating of Little Women that they did
Yeah.
two ago. What's her name? Directed it.
Oh, Greta, no.
Greta Gerwig.
Gerwig, yes.
In the, yeah, in The Angry Inch.
Greta Gerwig could be in this. She could be
She could
Zenobia.
be Zenobia. Yeah. Tom Hiddleston could be Coverdale.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I like that. Or this
Or Hollingsworth, actually.
might be our best one, adaptation wise.
I actually kind of know. Yeah, I don't know anybody younger than them, but yeah.
I hope
Yeah.
this gets it adapted to
I'd watch it. I'd be excited.
I
I'd be
know.
nervous. It's like, oh, are they going to make
Oh
it? Are they going to hit you over the head with a hammer? They're going to leave it as subtle as the book.
like it. I like it.
If
So that
you like this book, want to buy it?
yes.
If you live in Canada, in Vancouver, you know where you
Ooh.
should go?
Where should I go?
The People's Co-op Bookstore.
People's Co-op
Yeah. It's in
Bookstore.
Vancouver.
All right.
They're the oldest independent bookstore, I guess, in Vancouver. I don't know, in all of Canada. They carry a wide selection of new and used books across politics, history, fiction, activism, gender, etc.
Like it. I Vancouver, I've been once. It's a lovely city.
You like it? A lot of mountains.
They have I think this is right, Victoria Island. It's right across the inlet or whatever.
That where
This
the
is 20
Griffith
years
River
ago,
is?
so it might have changed quite a bit. And they have this lovely gardens and I don't know, quite enjoyed it. My only time in Canada, Vancouver.
I've
So
never
it's
been.
fitting that you mentioned an independent bookstore from there. I like
People's Co-op. Check
People's
them out.
Co-op, Vancouver, Canada.
There's also
Give me one more. I knew
in
you knew
Sacramento,
two.
California. Huh? Yeah, we'll do two. Sacramento, California, Ameritoria Fine Arts Books. They
Ameritorious.
are in, yeah. Ameritoria Fine Arts Books. Women owned and run. Artists also. They specialize in all things creative from architecture to papermaking.
I like that. I
And
like a
then, like,
good a bookstore where the craft of the book is kind of because it yeah, I like that. When you hold a well-made book, you notice. And I'm not sure that's entirely what you just said means, but that's what came to my mind.
Yeah. But it's kind of artist run and
Yeah.
not as a, you know, I think they And I think it works in a business concept. It's funny we mentioned it on the episode where we say utopias and human nature gets in the way of, but it's running a business is different than farming in a utopia.
There's also like the scope matters, right?
Yeah.
Like running someone's entire life.
Yeah.
You know, how they live, that, you know, how they interact with people, or just like, this is our little, and people are going to live their lives outside of this, but.
Yeah.
In this community,
running a business,
yeah,
fellow artists with an eye towards having that sort of ethos, and even the People's Co-op in Vancouver, the oldest bookstore in Vancouver, and it's a co-op, right? But they absolutely do something right. So contained on a small scale, that stuff works. So, unlike Black. Farms.
So we end the episode with saying it could work. It can work. Matt, let me go through some of the books that we have on the way that we're both kind of I would say right now, I would say A Time to Be Born, our new Don Powell book that we're doing, will be soon, right?
Yeah.
Mantlecore will probably come after that. The Master and Margarita is going to probably, I would guess, probably late spring, summer for that. And then we have our short stories that we have chosen to read. That would be The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, The Storm by Kate Chopin, and Honeysuckle Cottage by P.G. Woodhouse, Life and Fate, Once and Future King. I made a pledge earlier this week that I would make a push on the Once and Future King. So Matt, who has finished the book, can remember some of it before we discuss it. I have some essays I need to start reading this month by one David Foster Wallace. That is not a punishment, but something, it was a bet, I guess, that I lost. Yeah. So I'm going to be reading.
And you can spread them out. Just read one essay, and we'll talk about that essay, and then you can do another one in a couple of months.
That's fair. That's fair. I'm probably forgetting some stuff here.
Slow Horses will probably be halfway
through. Slow Horses. That'll be over on our Patreon. We're both in the process of reading that. I'm really enjoying it. Very British spy stuff. I love
that. Yeah.
I don't know.
Like a lot.
Some stuff is like, oh, the British do this well. You know, murder mystery, like the whole spy genre.
Detailed spy.
Yeah.
It's a fun book. Yeah. It's a
fun book. So if you're interested in that, go over and support us on our Patreon. We will also be diving into baseball upcoming over on our Patreon. We'll be reading books about baseball, discussing baseball. It's gonna a new year in baseball. Rule changes. I'm kind of excited. That's my hot take for the new rule changes. Well, I know you're probably going to be anti, you know, pitch clock and all like that.
I don't like the pitch clock.
I love
it. But I'm willing to, we'll go into it. There's some implications. We'll get into it later. I'll live with it, but I have some ideas.
You have some ideas. I like that. As always, reach out to us on our Instagram, Twitter, or you can send us an email at willbebooks@gmail.com. We are always interested in your questions, comments, all those good things. So send those over, and hopefully, for Matt's sake, we'll be able to do another mailbag episode here shortly. Matt,
send your questions.
Send your questions. And Matt, any final words of wisdom?
Just keeps some about Currents Reads. Currents Reads. Don't judge us too harshly. We're doing it on purpose.
We'll talk to you soon.